Well, on Radio 4, the first in a new series of RSVP, Matthew Paris investigates a letter written by Virginia Stephen to her future husband, Leonard Woolf.
In 1912, Virginia Stephen, her fame as the novelist Virginia Woolf still ahead of her, her suicide still years away, wrote the man she later married what is perhaps the most ambiguous, hesitating, discouraging acceptance of a marriage proposal in literary history. At least, Leonard Woolf took it as an acceptance.
May 1st, 1912. Dearest Leonard, it seems to me that I am giving you a great deal of pain, some of it in the most casual way. And therefore I ought to be as plain with you as I can, because half the time I suspect you're in a fog which I don't see at all. Of course I can't explain what I feel. These are some of the things that strike me. The obvious advantages of marriage stand in my way. I say to myself, anyhow you'll be quite happy with him, and he will give you companionship, children and a busy life. Then I say, by God, I will not look upon marriage as a profession. The only people who know of it all think it suitable, and that makes me scrutinize my own motives all the more. Then, of course, I feel angry sometimes at the strength of your desire. Possibly your being a Jew comes in also at this point. You seem so foreign. And then I am fearfully unstable. I pass from hot to cold in an instant, without any reason, except that I believe sheer physical effort and exhaustion influence me. All I can say is that in spite of these feelings, which go chasing each other all day long I am with you, there is some feeling which is permanent and growing. You want to know, of course, whether it will ever make me marry you. How can I say? I think it will, because there seems no reason why it shouldn't. But I don't know what the future will bring. Again, I want everything. Love, children, adventure, intimacy, work. Can you make any sense out of this ramble? I'm putting down one thing after another. So I go from being half in love with you and wanting you to be with me always and know everything about me to the extreme of wildness and aloofness. I sometimes think that if I married you, I could have everything. And then, is it the sexual side of it that comes between us? As I told you brutally the other day, I feel no physical attraction in you. There are moments. When you kissed me the other day was one, when I feel no more than a rock. And yet your caring for me as you do almost overwhelms me. It is so real and so strange. Why should you? What am I really except a pleasant, attractive creature? But it's just because you care so much that I feel I've got to care before I marry you. I feel I must give you everything. And that if I can't, well, marriage would only be second best for you as well as for me. If you can still go on as before, letting me find my own way, as that is what would please me best, and then we must both take the risks. But you have made me very happy, too. We both of us want a marriage that is a tremendous living thing, always alive, always hot, not dead and easy in parts, as most marriages are. We ask a great deal of life, don't we? Perhaps we shall get it. Then, how splendid. One doesn't get much said in a letter, does one? I haven't touched upon the enormous variety of things that have been happening here, but they can wait. Yours, V.S.
Leonard Woolf was a colonial servant on leave from Ceylon. Talking to a writer with a lifelong interest in Virginia Woolf, Michelle Roberts, and to Hermione Lee, who's working on a biography of Virginia, I asked Hermione what had prompted this letter.
He had proposed to her in January, and they had been seeing each other fairly constantly between January and May when this letter was written. They'd actually just spent the weekend together, and it was this week that he had to decide whether he was going to go back to Ceylon or whether he was going to resign from his job with no real prospects in view. She didn't actually accept him until May the 29th, so there was about another month's worth of indecision on her part. But it was this letter which decided Leonard to send in his resignation and to decide to stay in England.
How will he have reacted to this letter? How will he have taken it, Michelle?
I think he'll have felt very encouraged. I think what the letter demonstrates to me is her attempt to be honest, and that is the basis of their relationship subsequently as a couple. And this letter tracks a wonderful narrative because it starts with her saying, I and I can't, and it ends up with we. And there's all kinds of lovely verbs in it. We want, we ask, we shall get. So I feel Leonard must have felt very encouraged because almost unconsciously she's talking about the marriage as something that's going to happen, despite having expressed lots of doubts as well.
I mean, including saying the fact that you're a Jew is also something that makes me anxious.
Was that a normal thing to say to somebody who'd proposed to you, that the fact that he was a Jew was a bit of a problem?
It's very unusual for a woman of her upbringing and her class to marry a Jew. And she was well aware of that unusualness, and I think it's one of the reasons that she did marry Leonard, actually, which was there was a repudiation and a turning away of the kind of class that she was in. It's unusual for someone to think that and also to say it. I think it's part of the honesty of the letter that she says it. And I think that anti-Semitism is something she knows about and battles with, and in the course of her life, I think she comes to identify with Jewishness as a form of being an outsider to the establishment.
But take this remark. As I told you brutally the other day, I feel no physical attraction in you. There are moments when you kissed me the other day was one when I feel no more than a rock. Isn't that a desperately obvious rebuff to a man?
Well, I think that's an occasional feeling that erupts in her, the lack of feeling, and she tells him because of this attempt to be so honest. I think in Virginia Woolf, it isn't just about fear of sex or frigidity or coldness. Those are too simple, I think, as explanations. There's clearly a desire not to be overwhelmed in the inner self, which I think is a very modern feeling for women to be expressing, and women are still expressing those kinds of feelings.
I think it's also to do with the fact that she knows that she is going to need a lot of solitariness in her life, and not just sexual solitude, but intellectual solitude and emotional solitude. And this comes out very strongly in the novels. There are some fictional passages which are based on this letter in the novel Night and Day, which was published in 1919, where the heroine is undergoing this kind of courtship and actually says, when she finally accepts him, she had now to get used to the fact that someone shared her loneliness. And in Mrs. Dalloway, she also talks about the need for space in marriage.
This letter doesn't just come out of the blue, but responds to one from him, which came on very strong, am I right?
That's my impression, yes. So that the context of this letter is his letter, as in all relationships. It's a conversation, isn't it?
She does pick up specific phrases in his letter where he says, for instance, he doesn't want anything second best. And one of the things I think is so admirable about this letter, which seems to be a great mixture of sort of apprehension and courage and honesty and confusion, is that she says, no, we don't want anything second best. You know, we really want it to be as good as it possibly can be. She thinks of him as rather superior, I think, to her at this point. She says, what am I really but a pleasant, attractive creature? I mean, she's not Virginia Woolf at this point. She hasn't published a novel. She's a person who's started rather late for various reasons as a writer and is rather unconfident of herself. And I think one of the things she feels about Leonard is that he's going to be very superior, and in the best sense, he's going to give her first-rate life, not a second-best life.
Can I put another point of view to you, that this is the letter of a woman who, in fact, does not wish to marry the man, feels under all kinds of pressure to marry him and sees many advantages in marrying him, but is really fighting with something that she recognises very clearly in herself, an unwillingness to do it.
I think that's half the story. And I think she spells out the negatives very powerfully in the letter, as we've been saying, because of wanting him to know all the facts and to be honest. But I think the other half of the story is this growing feeling of trust and this feeling that they will have a full life and children and freedom and writing and love.
Yes. I mean, she says, I go from being half in love with you. So that's the start, half in love. And then she goes to the other extreme, she says, of wildness and aloofness. And that's almost like a slip there. If you put wildness and aloofness together, it's like wolfness. And I think she's actually, unconsciously, the language is letting out some desire.
But does she love him?
Well, not completely in this letter, I don't think.
Or at all.
But I think she quite wants to. Oh, there's absolutely no doubt that she loved him in her own peculiar way. And entries in the diary throughout her life where she talks about him as the core of my life or my inviolable centre. You cannot misread those. I think it's quite wrong to say, oh, he was a terrible dictator who made her go and lie down all the time. It's clear that he took on the role of looking after her and that she did feel his restrictiveness quite often, and she wanted to bust out and do things he didn't want to do. But there's absolutely no doubt that it was the absolute rock-solid centre of her life. And I think the fact that it is such, without being a marriage with children or a marriage that had, it had a certain kind of cosy, protective, playful sexual secret life, but not perhaps a very strong sexual life, that I think is an extraordinary dream.
And she does say things like, you know, I don't think any couple can ever have been as happy as we have been. Her very last letter to him before she killed herself was about how happy he had made her all their life together.
Did she have, at this stage, much choice? Were other men interested in her? Was this the first proposal she'd received?
She'd had three proposals, actually, and two of them this year. And so clearly the pressure was on to get married. And I think that is one of the things that she half is moved by and half resists.
Has she fallen head over heels in love with anybody?
I think she's been in love with women. And I think that one of the things that this marriage encompasses, with remarkably little trouble, is feelings of passionate love for other women.
I mean, I think she's someone who knew about love from a very early age. In one way, you can see her as having been very bruised, even scarred, by the death of her mother and the death of her half-sister, Stella. I mean, women who were of incredible importance in her very early life. I think she was marked for life by that. I think there's also a terrifically interesting relationship with her sister Vanessa, which encompasses great love, great attachment, and also, as sisters do, a bit of rivalry, a bit of envy, a bit of sort of mud wrestling goes on.
If I give you the what might be called the tabloid approach to the circumstances of this letter, which is that she's basically a suppressed lesbian being pushed towards marriage to a man for whom she feels nothing, you utterly reject that analysis.
I think the tabloid is always suggesting that there's a scandal to be revealed. Actually, what I think is impressive about this is that she is talking out loud and exploring and being as explicit as she can about the terms on which this relationship could possibly function. So I don't think this is, you know, secret scandal of closet lesbian, you know, marries would-be Jewish rapist. I mean, it's not that. I think it's someone with a peculiar and unusual sexual orientation and a whole history of very difficult mental problems, who is putting her cards on the table as much as she can.
Yes. I'm terribly impressed by this letter. I'm moved by its desire to be honest. And I think it really is a compliment to Leonard that he can take it and then hurl something back at her, which I'm sure he did, but we don't know.
Just apropos of when it happened, it's extraordinary to think that 2 days after this letter arrived, Leonard and Virginia went to the inquiry into the sinking of the Titanic, which had happened the month before. And when one thinks about these small historical points, you realise what an extraordinarily modern and pioneering letter this is.
If in this letter Virginia is implicitly laying down terms and conditions for the relationship, were they acceptable to him?
As far as I know, yes. I think he imposed back on her his own notion of a regime. He draws up these very sweet lists, addressing her as, you know, dearest little furry creature. You must rest, you must drink a glass of milk every morning, you must promise me to go to bed at 10:30 and go straight to sleep. So I think he decided to enter the game, that if she had her list of how things ought to be, he could add to it. I take my hat off to him that he obviously was deeply, deeply in love with her and therefore would do what she wanted.
I take my hat off to him too, but I wouldn't want to make too rosy a picture of it for him. I think at this stage he romanticises her like crazy, and there's an extraordinary little document that he wrote called Aspasia, where he turns all the characters in their social circle into Greek myths, as he calls the Bloomsburys the Olympians, and she is this cold, chaste, pure goddess up on a hilltop. And there's something of that, I think, in his feeling about her. And I think that it may well be that Leonard's romanticising of Virginia Stephen obviously had to change when she became Virginia Woolf. And I think that if there were lacks and gaps for him in the marriage, that he put it into a fiendish and extraordinary work schedule and coped with whatever gaps there were in that way, I think.
Do you think, on the basis of this letter, that the two of them, singly and jointly, made the right decision to marry? Michelle.
Well, it's an almost impossible question, which I know is why you're asking it. I think you have to say yes.
But Hermione, 29 years later, she kills herself. Is she now then about to make the right decision in marrying him?
And indeed she tries to kill herself 2 years later. I don't think Leonard drives her to suicide, if that's the question. Quite the reverse. I think he stops her from killing herself for as long as she didn't. I think that there's no doubt that he was a supporter and a carer and a helper. I think he was also a preventer in some ways. But it's very hard to imagine her life if she hadn't had someone there whom she could trust and speak to and have this kind of extraordinary, freely constructed companionship with. It's very hard to imagine what would have happened. I wouldn't want to say either that it was only because she was married to Leonard that she became a writer, or it was only because she was married to Leonard that she killed herself. I think either of those two extremes is unprovable. But I think somewhere in the middle there is a sense that he was the right person for her to marry, yes.
Marvellous, isn't it, how a simple first impression can appear so clumsy and crude after you've listened to the experts. Michelle and Hermione managed to make me feel I'd approached their friend Virginia like a tabloid journalist. They did, for the most part, convince me. But lingering stubbornly in the back of my mind is a cry I thought I heard in that letter, a real horror at the prospect of marriage, a horror Leonard Wolfe either failed to sense or simply pushed aside.
RSVP was presented by Matthew Paris. He was talking to Hermione Lee and Michelle Roberts. The letter was read by Janet Deal, and the series is produced by Julia Gillett in Birmingham.